Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Milwaukee Bucks podcast coming at you in the new year, 2020, the year of the next Milwaukee Bucks championship, potentially, perhaps. It's still looking pretty good. The Bucks are 32-5. We haven't chatted with you here in a couple weeks since we last spoke. The Bucks defeated, or I should say fell, to the Philadelphia 76ers and have responded quite nicely with five consecutive victories. Sixers have not done as well since that victory on Christmas Day. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the Journal Sentinel Milwaukee Bucks podcast. And on the other line in San Antonio is Matt Velasquez lamenting the 65 to 70 degree weather you have down in Texas. That's my understanding. Real drag, isn't it?
It's a hard life. I mean, that's just the burden I have to bear.
It's true. Last we spoke, it was a different decade. By the end of this, we'll chat a little bit about my list of the best Bucks games of the decade, the past decade. Not a lot of highlights, as of course many Bucks fans know, up until the very end of the decade. So I'll get your thoughts on that. We have to talk a little bit about Ersan Ilyasova, the man, the myth, the legend. But I'm going to start with that game in Philadelphia. I know it's been a while now, but the Bucks did lose on Christmas Day to Philadelphia. Really, really got handled pretty well. And the 76ers have come off of that game losing. I believe it's up to four straight, or at least it was at least three straight last I checked. While the Bucks, of course, have while not playing top flight competition, have been fine. They've won five consecutive games. Going into a game Monday night again against San Antonio, they won on Saturday night at Pfizer Forum against the Spurs. Kind of a quirky back-to-back that Matt wrote about at jsonline.com in San Antonio on Monday night. By the time you hear this, that game may be over. This is kind of a tight posting schedule this week, but still, I'll kind of go back to a question I asked on the last podcast, the things you were looking for in that matchup with Philadelphia, the matchups you were paying attention to, the things you wanted to see from the Bucks, and maybe that wasn't their best performance, but did you see anything in that game that indicates some concern that the 76ers might be this matchup that I guess we'd be afraid to see at the beginning of the year? And in the game since, in the five wins since, have they addressed that in any way or moved on in any way or maybe since the Sixers have struggled, maybe there's nothing to take away from that one game on Christmas Day. What do you think about that, Matt?
I think taking the game chronologically, I think I was first interested in how the Bucks were going to match up with the 76ers' size. I mean, they put out such a big starting lineup with Josh Richardson being like the smallest guy, and he's pretty, pretty sizable himself. But they put out, Ben Simmons, Tobias Harris, Al Horford, Joel Embiid. And initially, the Bucks put Wesley Matthews on Al Horford. That allowed Giannis to stay on Ben Simmons, where you would expect that he'd be able to, to drop off of Simmons and, help other guys on defense. And so I thought that matchup was interesting. Maybe in future matchups down the road, the Bucks decide to go bigger and put like Ersan Ilyasova in the starting lineup and try to match up size-wise. But I don't think, that lack of size or height posed a problem immediately. I think the biggest problem in that game was that, the 76ers, which don't shoot a ton of threes and don't, aren't necessarily a great three-point shooting team, they were a great three-point shooting team in that game. I mean, they made 21 three-pointers on 44 attempts. It's something that's, not really going to happen all that often, but the Bucks do allow a lot of three-pointers. It's part of what their defense does. They try and give up not threes, but they want teams to shoot, mid-range shots. Teams know that. They know that, the Bucks are going to try and goad you into those types of shots. And so instead of, taking the bait, the Sixers just, shot three after three after three, and they knocked them down. And for the season, the Sixers aren't some, three-point shooting juggernaut. I mean, they attempt only 33s a game, which is 25th in the league. And their three-point percentage is about average. And so this was an extreme outlier game, for the Sixers, which, that's the kind of thing that's going to happen against the Bucks. Like, the Bucks have, made a decision on their defense, at least in the regular season, that they're not going to necessarily switch as much, that they're going to kind of stay in their scheme, and they're going to live with kind of what happens. They're going to assume that teams don't shoot like this, on a nightly basis. And in the four games since they played the Bucks, the Sixers are shooting 27.8% from three on 28 attempts per game. So it definitely isn't something that we normally see when it comes to the Sixers, but they got hot. And, the Bucks eventually got to the point where they were down like 29 and they had really no other options. They switched to zone, and that allowed them to come back a little bit, though I think the Sixers kind of stopped trying at that point. They knew the game was over. And so that's something that really stands out. What also stands out is Giannis Antetokounmpo like really doing nothing in that game. And I'm interested to see how much of that was the Sixers' defense. I mean, he was 8 of 27 from the floor and 0 for 7 on threes. How much of that was Joel Embiid and Al Horford and Ben Simmons and just the size and the length that the 76ers were able to throw at him? How much of that was just kind of bad luck? You know, seven threes, they were all wide open. You know, I don't think he's going to miss seven, you know, all that often. Also, he got inside multiple times, and he had shots that were the kind of shots he likes to take inside, and they just didn't go in. And then also, that was the game where I remember before the game watching him, I was on the baseline, he was getting ready for the game, and he had to stop a couple times and like stretch out his back and you know, try and twist and contort and get himself, you know, kind of feeling right, because he was dealing with a back injury at that point. He didn't talk about it as anything that affected his game, but he then sat out the next two games with back soreness. And so, you know, how close to 100% was he against the Sixers? And, you know, how much did maybe that affect him? So I know a lot of people are going to read into that game and say, oh, well, the Bucks got trounced, and this is going to be a huge matchup problem. It's going to be a big issue for the playoffs and all that stuff. But the Bucks and Sixers play three more times before the playoffs. I'd like to kind of see a bigger sample size before really, you know, looking into what that matchup means or what it meant. And we'll get to see him twice in February. I mean, they're coming to Pfizer Forum on February 6th and February 22nd. So, you know, I think we can wait about a month, you know, for that next matchup, and we'll see what happens. And, you know, once we get a little bit of a bigger sample size, then we can figure out exactly how this matchup looks as opposed to just judging off Christmas.
Kind of a fun week there at the end of January into that first week of February. Like you said, February 6th, the Sixers will be at Pfizer Forum. January 31st, the Bucks will host the Nuggets, kind of in that cluster of teams right below the Lakers for the second best team in the Western Conference. So that'll be a game to circle as well. Bucks will be on the road, though, in the immediate future. Starting with this game Monday night against the Spurs, games against the Warriors, Kings, and Trailblazers on the road in the on the immediate horizon. But like we mentioned, since that Bucks 76ers game, that 121-109 finish back on Christmas Day, Sixers have lost four in a row. The Bucks have handled most of their opponents, the Hawks, the Bulls, and the Magic. Three pretty easy wins that followed there, as you mentioned, two of them without Giannis playing. And then came Wednesday on New Year's Day, kind of an interesting game against the Minnesota Timberwolves. The Bucks win 106-104. Game came down to a final possession in which the Timberwolves had the ball, had a chance to tie or win, and it turned into a disastrous possession. The Bucks defense really shining through on that last drive, and kind of nice because the Bucks don't get a lot of chances to play in those one possession games that come down to the wire. They've had a few of them this year, but quite honestly, this is just not a team that's going to run into that a lot. And it sort of was another highlight point of Brook Lopez and Robin Lopez's interior defense. And that's been a running theme. I know you wrote about that at jsonline.com. We have talked about it before, the value, particularly Brook Lopez's interior defense and how great it has been. But I kind of want to give you a chance to talk about it again, because it's really kind of otherworldly. And we've written about it, and there's this chart that shows just how far above and beyond the Lopez brothers are. I guess I'm curious, if maybe you can sort of contextualize, put into words, how good it really is to have those two guys in the paint. And more than that, is that something you think the Bucks were expecting when they signed Robin Lopez? Did they anticipate that they would be able to create this juggernaut of interior defense? Because obviously that's not, you know, the Bucks were the shooting team last year. I don't know if anybody really was thinking the Bucks are going to emphasize inside defense this year, but here they are with the best in the league. Give me some thoughts on the Lopez brothers.
Yeah, I think this is exactly what the Bucks were envisioning, honestly. It's an offshoot or an extension of what they did last year. I mean, they were the best. I think they were the best, or if not one of the best, teams at defending inside the restricted area last year, which had a lot to do with Brook Lopez contesting the most shots in the NBA, and obviously having Giannis Antetokounmpo to help off the weak side or to raise shots or contest shots alongside Brook. So bringing in Robin, I mean, Bud mentioned the other day that, you know, last year there was something that was maybe missing from last year's team was that traditional backup center, somebody who could step in and be physical and have that size and height, similar to Brook. And, it turns out exactly the same as Brook. Being able to plug and play and to be able to shift Ersan Ilyasova away from playing the five in a backup capacity and maybe be more naturally at the four, and have Robin, who, can test shots like Brook and can block shots and can give you some offensive, contributions in the form of, jump hooking people to death. It's all a good, maybe a better roster fit than maybe they had last year. And so, this is what they want to do. Like we talked about earlier, how they allow jump shots, they allow mid-range shots, they allow teams to get a few more above the break three-pointers than other teams would. But what they don't allow is teams to score inside. The Bucks, remain the best team, in the league in terms of field goal percentage against in the restricted area. They really make teams work inside the paint. And I remember on what day is today? Today is Monday, right? So that must mean that on Saturday against the Spurs, there was a play where, actually a few plays, but one that in particular where LaMarcus Aldridge tried to score inside against Brook Lopez and Yasta Kumbo. And I leaned over to my my colleague at the Athletic, Eric Name, and I said, hey, like, good luck scoring on those two. And that's just kind of what it is. Like if you're going to go inside, no matter how big, how strong you are, and you're going to try and score against, Giannis, who was in the running for Defensive Player of the Year last year, who has a ton of size and length and athleticism and bounce, and then Brook Lopez, who is, sitting on a career high rate of blocking shots. He's a 7-footer. He holds his ground. He's not going to get pushed over. Like, if you have to score over those two guys, like, that's, about as hard of a challenge as you're going to find in the NBA when it comes to two guys who are swarming you on defense. And so, the ability for the Bucks to know that Brook is behind them, or Robin, in certain situations, but mostly Brook, like, knowing that he's behind them, I think is a positive. I'll probably write about this sometime this week too. Giannis was saying recently that sometimes it makes them play worse defense because they just expect Brook to take everything and reject it at the rim. So if someone gets by them, they're like, it's okay, Brook's there. And like for him, like usually he's like bouncing around the court, doing all kinds of stuff, feel like he has to cover up mistakes on defense. And he's felt like he really hasn't had to or hasn't been able to do that as much this year because Brook's been doing it all, which is a little bit of a new wrinkle to the story that you mentioned. Like, we've written about Brook and his interior defense many times. I mean, it's been a constant over the past season and a half that he's been here. And so I think that's a little bit of a different wrinkle that the guys maybe need to realize, hey, like, we shouldn't just send everybody to Brook. We should, make sure we're taking care of our business up front first.
I believe I saw Brook Lopez has more blocks per minute than any other starter in the NBA, and I believe is second overall when you factor in bench guys. So he is a wall, and that has certainly contributed to the Bucks' success. Their defense, no strangers last year too. They were one of the best, if not the best, defensive team in basketball. So it's not like this is a surprise. But Eric Bledsoe back in action since we last chatted. He, correct me if I'm wrong, but came back for that Bulls game, I believe, right before the Timberwolves game, and has been contributing and looked pretty good, I guess. And I'm curious, just I guess off the top, your thoughts on Eric Bledsoe, how he has looked since returning from injury.
Oh, I think he's looked really good. Obviously, in the first couple games he played, he was on limited minutes and wasn't able to do as much. But I think he shot the ball really well. I mean, obviously against the Spurs the other night, 8 of 12 from the floor, 4 of 6 on threes. Definitely fits the bill. But he's I'm trying to look up the stats here. These stats aren't right at all, I don't think. because in the first two games, I was trying to go on Basketball Reference, shout out to Basketball Reference, and then highlight his game log and get some stats. And it said that, he was shooting 25% on threes in the past three games. And I was like, that's not true. But then apparently I had highlighted three games, but it was only calculating two games. So now we're back. So, you know, the three games he's played, he's averaged 20 minutes a game, which I think is about where the Bucks want him to be. He's gone up like steadily about 4 minutes a game, from 16 to 20 to 24 in the three games he's played. But he's, you know, shooting 56.7%. He's made half his threes. You know, four rebounds, 3.7 assists, 1.7 steals. I mean, he's doing typical Eric Bledsoe stuff. I think his passing has been generally pretty good, in the way he's been able to drive the lane and find guys. I don't think he's trying to do too much necessarily. You know, I think he's just, you know, he's found his way. And when we talked to a bunch of guys in Chicago after Bledsoe returned, you know, Chris Middleton mentioned that they call him the Ferrari around their locker room, something I hadn't heard before, just because he is so fast and low to the ground, and he pushes the pace, and he really gets them going. And, you know, I asked him, and I asked, you know, Giannis Antetokounmpo, like, if they could tell the difference when Bledsoe's on the court, and they're like, oh yeah, like, he's just so fast. He makes you go so much faster because you know he's going to go fast and he's going to push the pace. And if he gets the ball off a rebound, or, you know, even off an inbound, like, he's going. And so everybody needs to hustle and be ahead of the play, or be along with him, or ready to trail. And so that's something that the Bucks, you know, that's what they like to do. They like to, you know, run out and try and score quickly, and, you know, get as many possessions as possible. This is a team that, you know, they rank first in the league in pace, which isn't just, you know, playing fast or on an individual possession, but it's getting as many possessions in a game as possible. You know, and they are obviously turning that into a lot of good things with the top ranked defense in the league and the third best offense in the league. You know, they think they're at their best when they can be, you know, pushing and trying to take advantage of teams getting back on defense, not being set. Obviously, when you have the best transition weapon in the league in Giannis Antetokounmpo, you want to emphasize that as much as possible. And having Eric Bledsoe back definitely helps in that regard.
Yeah, there's a reason why the Bucks are pushing 60 consecutive games at 100 points or more, a streak that's been in jeopardy a couple times since we last chatted. I wasn't sure in the 76ers game, the Timberwolves game, but sure enough, the Bucks, with the pace they play, they're just bound to, and the offensive efficiency, they're just bound to hit 100 or more every game. You did mention Chris Middleton there, that he refers to Eric Bledsoe as a Ferrari. Chris Middleton's kind of, you know, his own special brand of sports car this year. He's having another great year, and you wrote about that at JSOnline.com, talking about sort of his all-star status, that he is kind of in that conversation again. Do you think that's where we're headed, that we're going to see? I mean, the Bucks are going to get a lot of consideration for a second all-star representative, given how well they've played. There is, as we've mentioned many times, this prevailing sentiment that it is just Giannis and the Seven Dwarfs, that no one else is at that caliber, even though time and time again they have guys who sort of prove what level they're on. But Chris Middleton has taken his lion's share of criticism. I don't know if we're hearing as much of that this year, though. He's been solid, and do you think if things were to end the way they are right now, that he would be going back to the All-Star game for a second year in a row?
You know, last year I felt pretty confident that the Bucks were going to get a second All-Star, and this year I'm less confident.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, not that Chris hasn't been good. As I wrote, you know, obviously he's not playing a ton of minutes because that's just what the Bucks do, right? Like, they blow out a lot of teams. They don't have to rely on their guys for as many minutes. You know, he's only playing 28.3 minutes per game, and he's, you know, actually right now, you know, ahead of last year's numbers, at least in terms of scoring, definitely in terms of shooting. You know, his per 36 numbers are fantastic. You know, 24 points a game, you know, over seven rebounds, about five assists. You know, his effective field goal percentage, as far as I last saw, yeah, it's the best of his career. So he's shooting well inside, shooting well outside. Definitely has a good argument. But I think that there's a bunch of players in the East that are just better in general, not just better than him, but the East has more good players, more deserving players than maybe seasons past. And it's all going to come down to the coach vote, because he's not going to make it as a starter. That we all are okay with and understand. But then the coaches, you know, they fill out the reserves. And so depending on how the coaches decide to reward either individual players or teams heading into the All-Star break is really going to decide this, because there are a ton of guys. I mean, just looking up and down the standings, You look at Boston, Kemba Walker, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown. Those guys are all, you know, definitely worthily in the conversation. Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo for the Heat. Kyle Lowry, the way he's playing recently, he has to be an all-star. He has been outstanding for the Raptors. And then you add in Pascal Siakam, who's probably going to start in the all-star game, or at least is very likely to compete for one of those starting spots because of the way that he's played so far. We haven't gotten to the Sixers yet, you know, and Joel Embiid is going to be there. You know, Ben Simmons has a strong argument. Malcolm Brogdon and Domantas Sabonis, like, they've, you know, become one of the most fearsome, you know, pick and roll duos in the league, and they've been playing really well for the Pacers. I think one of them really should be in the All-Star game this year. Kyrie Irving might get voted in, might not. He's barely played for the Nets, but right now he has the fan vote. He probably won't get the player vote or the media vote, so that might knock him out, and then maybe he won't be there at all, which would kind of open up a spot that, you know, perennially would go to him. You know, you look at what Bradley Beal has done on a team that's not very good with the Wizards, but he's been great. Trae Young, same thing. And, you know, that's skipping over still like five or six other teams. So, you know, it's a pretty crowded race for those all-star spots. And, you know, if the coaches decide to reward the Bucks with the second spot because they were the best, you know, the best team in the league, like it last year, but probably even more so, it'll be met with some criticism. Because, you know, if you could have, you know, one of the two Celtics wings instead of Chris Middleton, or if you could have, you know, maybe even Malcolm Brogdon if he doesn't make it, or if Bradley Beal for whatever reason doesn't make it, I mean, you know, there's going to be a lot of questions to answer and a lot of worthy candidates. And so, you know, there might be some blowback if Chris Middleton makes it. I think that'd be, you know, a fair argument to have or discussion to have, but at the same time doesn't detract from what he's been able to do, you know, very quietly, I feel like, this season, you know, putting up some of the best, actually the best shooting numbers of his career and providing a complimentary scoring option and, you know, also a solid playmaker and defensive option too for a team that is the best in the league.
One of the dumbest things I ever said was a couple years ago when the Bucks signed Ersan Ilyasova at the stroke of midnight when it was fair game to announce that you had agreed to terms with new free agents, that they agreed that they had Ilyasova in-house. And at that point, I don't remember exactly the logistics, but I knew that move made it clear that they were not going to have the money, the financial wherewithal to bring back Jabari Parker. And I thought that was a bad move because it demonstrated to the world that they weren't going to have Parker back, and it limited the leverage they had to try and trade him. You look back a couple years later, obviously Jabari Parker has really struggled and hasn't really gotten a foothold, at least as an all-around player. I mean, he's still a fine offensive player, but the Bucks were obviously right to move on from him. And Ersan Ilyasova has gone on to become a generational talent who is the greatest player in the NBA right now. I will hear no arguments to the contrary. So I don't know how he's doing it, if there's some fountain of youth thing going on with him, but he's obviously been a huge component to this bench that has helped this team keep these superstars' minutes totals down. You know, they just don't lose a lot when this bench comes on. And last year, I thought Ilyasova's contributions were fine. There was a little bit of a novelty aspect because he's got this uncanny ability to draw charges. This year, I mean, he's just getting better as he gets older. I'm confused, Matt. Explain why is Ersan Ilyasova?
I don't know. Ersan gonna Ersan. Like, that's just... Like, he is what he is, and he does what he does, and no one really fully understands it or can describe it or can understand it, but he just keeps on going. And the weird thing is that I'm pretty sure he hasn't taken a charge since December 11th.
It's over. He's changed from novelty to superstar.
It doesn't make sense. Yeah, you know, he joked the other day. He's like, "Oh, I used to take charges, and I don't take charges anymore." Like, and, you know, he was kind of, you know, lamenting that part of his career is over and has been taken from him by the referees. But, you know, when Giannis sat out the two games after Christmas, you know, he was a scoring and rebounding machine, 18 points, 17 rebounds against the Hawks on 7 of 8 shooting, mind you.
Incredible.
And then 17 points, 14 rebounds. Oh, and then Giannis comes back and Ersan comes off the bench and in less than 20 minutes has 14 points and 11 rebounds. You know, kind of getting it done in a whole bunch of different ways. Shooting three pointers. He was 5 of 6 against the Magic. you know, scoring inside, putting back offensive rebounds. It's just kind of astounding what he's always able to do. He does it all in his own way. I always joke that I feel like he only makes the shots that look harder. Like, you know, when he doesn't need to shoot a sidestep or a step back three, and maybe it's more covered than it would have been otherwise, that's the one that goes in. Or, you know, the random, you know, fadeaway where he is standing straight up and down, and instead of just shooting, he like fades. Like, that's just kind of his style. Like, that goes in. The ones where he's like twisting and turning and like batting the ball around on the inside, none of it makes sense. All of it is weird. And it's all just totally Ersan. And so, you know, he's been really important to what the Bucks have been able to do. As I mentioned earlier, you know, because of Robin Lopez's presence, he's playing less at the five, which, you know, means a little bit less wear and tear on him, a little bit more ability to attack and space the floor, and maybe have better matchups where, you know, not just defensively where he's not banging up against the biggest guy in the court, but, you know, on offense, you know, he might have somebody who, you know, maybe is giving up a little height or giving up a little size on him, and he's able to do a little bit more with that, and whether that's, you know, getting shots up or being able to get around guys or pass guys or become invisible and get into the paint for rebounds or anything like that. But just overall, I mean, he's been really good. He's somebody who, you know, going into the season, I thought, okay, maybe they trade Ersan because he is on an expiring deal. He has a team option for next year. So maybe they can move him. And since he's making $7 million this year, he might be a piece that would allow the Bucks to match salaries and get somebody different in a trade to upgrade in whatever way they might think they need to. But right now, I mean, he is either, you know, increasing his trade stock dramatically, or, you know, he is trying to prove to the Bucks, hey, like, I can be a really important part of what you're doing right now, and watch, just hold on to me because I got this.
I'm glad you mentioned trades, because I do want to talk about that real quickly. We're still a month away. That February 6th game against Philadelphia also happens to be the trade deadline, so that'll be an exciting time in Milwaukee and everywhere across the NBA. There are a lot of guys out there that are going to be presumably on the market. I don't know what the Bucks would really be in the market for, because if you add a really true impact guy, I know Drew Holiday's name has been thrown around a lot, you do have to cross off a few guys. It's not going to be just a one-for-one trade. You know, you mentioned Ersan. There's certainly other guys in the starting rotation and on the bench that would probably be in the crosshairs there of a move, and I don't know if you're 32-5 if you tinker with that formula. I mean, that's a pretty good formula. I know it's all about what comes in the playoffs, but the Bucks kind of have this system figured out. We could talk about some of the specific guys or what the specific needs are that they might address eventually, but as it stands right now with a month to go before the trade deadline, I guess just how are you feeling one way or the other? Do you think the Bucks are going to make a trade, and maybe another category, a significant trade, or are they just going to maybe, you know, work around the fringes or something?
Yeah, this is such a tough call. I actually wrote about this before the season started. And like one of my preview articles, I ended it with like one big question, or maybe it was in the middle. I think it was that Milwaukee, like 4-1-4, like four reasons to believe, one big question, four reasons to doubt that the Bucks can like win a championship this year. And that one big question was, will they make a trade? Because right now this roster is really well suited to what they need. They obviously have Giannis, they have Middleton, you know, they have Bledsoe, they have Lopez. They brought those four guys back from last year. They all seem to fit in the roles that they have, offensively and defensively. We know that those four worked well enough last year to help to get the Bucks to the Eastern Conference Finals. And I say that only because Malcolm Brogdon didn't play in like the first two rounds of the playoffs. So it was those four guys, in particular, those four starters, who really helped get the Bucks to the Eastern Conference Finals. And we all know what happened there. But then George Hill has been playing just outstanding basketball. He's the best three-point shooter in the league as of right now, you know, through, 37 games. Ersan, we just talked about. Dante DiVincenzo has really come along, you know, and he has fit a role, you know, just deflecting. I feel like everything, stealing a whole bunch of passes each game. You know, he hasn't shot very well. I think he's cooled off He's down to 32% on threes, something that he'll need to do better if he's going to be able to help the Bucks at his highest level. Wesley Matthews, you know, maybe people would think that the Bucks could upgrade at that position, that second guard position, maybe find someone with maybe more creative ability on offense, or maybe more size or something like that. But I think Wes, you know, has been doing well in what the Bucks have asked him to do. He's shooting 36% on threes, or a little bit above that. You know, he doesn't need the ball very often. He has stepped up on defense when relied upon a lot of times this season, most notably against the Lakers and guarding LeBron James. And he's on a really good contract. Kyle Korver, Robin Lopez, you know, we talked about him. They need him, or they want him in a secondary center role. Pat Connaughton has really come along recently. So, you know, I think that this roster, like, it really fits together and really works. You know, could you, you know, try and do like a Marc Gasol type trade, like the Raptors did last year, and try and take one of those guys, those, you know, contributing important rotational guys, and try and turn that person, along with maybe a couple others or a draft pick or whatever, into something more? Like, sure you can. You can definitely, you know, make a run at somebody if you want to try and improve on the front end. Of course, that's really hard and comes with certain inherent risks. And it all depends on who you are able to get, how they perform, and what you have to give up. But then, you know, could the Bucks do something on the fringes? Like you said, like Sterling Brown is in the last year of his contract. He's kind of fallen out of the rotation, partly because the other wings are playing well, and partly because, you know, when he's been in the rotation, there was a game, you know, within the last week or so, I think against the Magic, where he, you know, messed up a couple defensive assignments, and after, you know, being part of the rotation early, didn't play the rest of the game, and he hasn't really played since. So, you know, maybe they can try and find a team that would be interested in acquiring him so that they would have his bird rights and be able to, you know, have him as a restricted free agent next year. Maybe, you know, bring him back, you know, knowing that they had control. DJ Wilson hasn't been in the rotation much this season. Not that he doesn't have promise, not that he's not an interesting piece, but if the Bucks are going to keep Ersan, there's just not going to be minutes for DJ, and he's under contract next year too, so they are under no obligation to move him. But since he's under contract next year, maybe teams might say, hey, like, we're interested in that guy. That's an asset, somebody we want to figure out, you know, what he can be. Maybe it's a team that has a worse record right now, and they would have the minutes for DJ, and they'd be able to give him an opportunity maybe this year and next year, and decide if they want to make him part of their future. You know, so, but the problem for the Bucks is that if you're going to move on from guys like Sterling and DJ, their salaries aren't very high. And so if you're going to, whoever you bring back is going to have to be on a relatively low, you know, low contract or small contract right now. So you'd really be, you know, working along the fringes, as we said, to try and upgrade this roster. And right now the Bucks, you know, they have a ton of depth, and do they want to sacrifice some of their depth in order to have a little bit higher talent ceiling come playoff time? I am interested to see if they are able to, or how they are able to do that, if they decide to make a change, and who they're able to get, and really what their you know, what their threshold is for risk. Because, you know, obviously if you have something great right now, you don't want to mess it up too much, but maybe, you know, taking the risk might be the thing that puts you over the top come springtime. So I think it'll be fascinating to see what they do, you know, and how they're able to potentially upgrade as we get closer to the trade deadline.
Let's wrap this up by talking about something a little more fun and offbeat. That's the mentioned at the outset, Bucks best games of the decade. I did put my list together at jsonline.com. You can check out the full list. My number one, I'm curious if it's the same as your number one. I bet it's not. It was difficult, actually, to come up with some obvious choices, because either the Bucks weren't a serious contender for the you know, for the NBA championship for most of the decade, or they were blowing everybody out to the point that you didn't have many close games, many meaningful, you know, games that really stood out. I'd say last year, if you look at the regular season, there's really only two or three games that are going to come to mind. Maybe that home game against the Celtics right after the All-Star break, or game on the road against the Raptors. But for the most part, it was kind of all blowouts. There weren't many good ones. My number one game of the decade was Giannis beating the New York Knicks at the buzzer at Madison Square Garden a few years ago. Felt like, to me, that was sort of the spiritual launching point of the Giannis phenomenon. And obviously in the years since, he's become arguably, or maybe inarguably, the best player in the NBA. There were a couple others that I was choosing between kind of up there on the list. The 24-1 game where they beat the Golden State Warriors for their first loss of the season. Obviously, there's the playoff games last year. There's some pretty exciting moments then. What would you put at the very top of your list if you're choosing a best Bucks game of the last decade?
You know, it's so tough. And part of it is just, you know, I'd probably be biased to games I was at. Just because, you know, those are the ones that you remember most vividly. I'm glad that you had the Jared Bayless at the buzzer game. Obviously, that series was 3-0 in favor of the Bulls. But, you know, that moment felt like a cathartic one. It was fun and all that stuff for sure. I think game, what was it, 4 against the Celtics a couple years ago with the deli scoop, and Giannis, you know, putting him ahead with a couple seconds left. That one stood out. That was, you know, probably the most fun, intense, like craziest game that I witnessed at the Bradley Center. So that one was, I think, stands out a little bit. The recent Lakers game, like that one was, sure. You know, was great, you know, for the Bucks. I think that when you look at, the Warriors 24-1 game, I think that really, that could have been number one. I wasn't there. I remember I was covering Marquette in my first season covering Marquette, and that was the day of the Marquette Wisconsin game. And so I couldn't pull double duty because it was in Madison. And I was really hoping to be able to go from Madison straight to the Bucks Warriors game. I just couldn't make it work to be able to help Charles Gardner out there, you know, with coverage slash just being able to see the game myself. Very selfish of me. but that game, I feel like, you know, you mentioned like putting the Bucks on the map. Like that one, and that one didn't really fully get them there. You know, they were still a couple years away, but at least it was like, hey, like this is a young team that has guys that can do some stuff. And yes, like the Warriors were on a back-to-back at the end of a long road trip, but the Bucks came to play and they brought it, and they kind of signaled like, hey, in a couple years, like we're gonna be here. I mean, at the time, I think they thought we're like almost there, like we're getting there, but you know, now we know like they were further away than we thought at that time. I think I would also kind of put in my memory, one of the ones that stands out is the game against the Knicks, when Giannis dunked over Tim Hardaway. That was also the game where Kristaps Porzingis tore his ACL.
Yes. And
that game felt really momentous, and you know, probably years down the line will be remembered, you know, broadly for the Porzingis injury. That was the last, that was really the end of his Knicks tenure, and signaled, the time when he was gonna, you know, eventually shift away from the Knicks and now go to the Mavericks. And, you know, that was a big one. I think if we're looking at, important games too, of the decade, you know, a loss last year, the double overtime game in game 3 against the Raptors. I mean, the Bucks did win,
of course. Yeah.
But that game, you know, that a few bounces of the ball here or there, changes maybe, you know, like everything about this franchise. You know, if they're able to win that game and be up 3-0, I don't think they lose 4 in a row at that point. I think maybe they're able to close out that series and go to the finals and then give themselves a shot, you know, to win it. Obviously, the Raptors did win it. You know, if the Bucks had gotten there, they would have had every opportunity. And so, you know, I think that game, while a Bucks loss, I think it is a important and memorable game, in terms of like a what if.
I definitely agree. I didn't put that. I might have mentioned that in my honorable mentions. I didn't put it on my main list because it became a bigger deal, I would say, retroactively. It felt like the turning point of that series, whereas at the time, Bucks were up 2-0. You figured they could get away with a loss in double overtime. In fact, you felt really good going into game four. And that was also a very ugly game. It wasn't very well played. It kind of it just sort of slogged on through a couple overtimes. And again, history probably pivots if the Bucks can hold on and win that game. Some big shots by Chris Middleton. Didn't put that other Knicks game in there, I know, because that was probably more of a Knicks memory. You know, the Tim Hardaway dunk is a moment that I think we'll all never forget, but that was probably something Knicks fans think of more than Bucks fans in terms of where it stands. A couple others that I had in there, one that I just love, is Chris Middleton's buzzer beater against Miami. It came in the context of, you know, one of these seasons that didn't necessarily go anywhere, much like that 24-1 team, which did not even go to the playoffs. I didn't remember that, but Middleton makes a three, just barely releases it at the buzzer against Dwayne Wade in the Heat. After just a scramble for the ball, Jared Bayless took a jump ball, you know, on the other end, on the defensive end, and or on the offensive end, on Miami's end, and Zaza Pachulia saves it from out of bounds, gets it to Middleton, who barely gets the shot off, and it goes in. Crazy celebration at the Bradley Center after that. And then also a game that maybe gets forgotten about a little bit in 2010, that Fear the Deer year, where the Bucks took the Hawks to 7 games in the first round and won on the road in game 5. Brandon Jennings had a big game. Carlos Delfino, there's a name, hit a big shot that gave the Bucks a 3-2 lead. They came home, and the buzz in this city was monstrous around that 2010 opening round playoff series. Felt like the Bucks were going to steal a first round series. They had a lot of no names on that team, a lot of scrappy guys playing, you know, career years. Andrew Bogut was injured. They were putting it together with guys like John Salmons and Delfino, and they laid an absolute egg at home in Game 6, and the Hawks went on to win Game 7 pretty convincingly as well. So a lot of fun games to talk about. Like we said, there's probably going to be quite a few more candidates, I would guess, in this next decade of Bucks basketball, perhaps starting with what we have in the weeks ahead, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, obviously with the way this team is playing and what their prospects are for the future, it's not like they're not entering this decade in the same way they did last year, where, you know, yes, the Fear of Deer season was happening, but the Bogut injury, you know, and all the flux that they had there kind of led to a few years of not great, not bad, but not great, very mediocre basketball. And then eventually, you know, cratering at 15 and 67, not much memorable from those years, unless you want to count like really bad losses and really weird lineup combinations and the time when people thought Nate Walters was better than Giannis and all that kind of stuff. That's all like
good times.
So memorable stuff. Miroslav Radulica, you know, saying he loves Saturday nights, if you know what I mean. Like, just weird stuff. Stuff that I remember, no one else should remember because it was all not important. You know, but I think now that the Bucks are coming in, they're, you know, with the best record in the league heading into the new year, the new decade. You know, they have championship aspirations, and you know, with that, we're gonna have a bunch of memorable games, because no matter what happens this year in the playoffs, whether the Bucks go far or they don't, like, it's going to be stuff that that really, you know, emotionally impacts people and stands out over time, because, you know, the hopes are just so high.
Let's be honest, the highlight of that 2013-2014-15 win season came in the offseason when they made the 15th selection in the 2013 NBA draft. That was the actual number one moment of the decade, even though it can't be counted as a game. So
that's true. Best moment for the Bucks all decade was when David Stern announced number 15, Giannis Antetokounmpo from Greece. That was number one.
It did work out. All right, Matt, that's what we got. Let's wrap it up there. The Bucks again. Again, sorry for the timing. You're probably hearing this either right after the Bucks have played the Spurs, maybe shortly beforehand, but the Bucks will be playing the Spurs Monday night in San Antonio. It's the first of 4 games on this West Coast swing. They'll be at it's not the Oracle anymore. What's the name of the Golden State Warriors' new arena?
The Chase Center.
The Chase Center. They'll be at the Chase Center. It's not going to be quite the same buzz as it was last year when the Bucks went to Golden State and won, but it'll still be, I guess, somewhat notable. And then they'll be back at Pfizer Forum in about 10 days. Thanks for joining us, Matt. We will chat with you again very soon.
All right. We'll talk to you next week.
Find us on Stitcher, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at JRRadcliffe. That's JRRADCLIFFE. You can also find Matt Velasquez, Matt_Velasquez, very easily on Twitter as well. Thanks for tuning in. We will chat with you again next week.